Bleak House by Charles Dickens. Dramatized in 8 episodes by Betty Davis. With Michael Bryant, Sarah Kestelman, Robert Lang, and Brenda Breffin as Esther Summerson. Part 6. Closing In.
It matters little now how much I thought of my living mother who had told me to consider her dead. I could not venture to approach her or to communicate with her in writing, for my sense of the peril in which her life was passed was only to be equalled by my fears of increasing it. It matters little how often I recalled the tones of my mother's voice, wondered whether I should ever hear it again, as I so longed to do, and thought how strange and desolate it was that it should be so new to me. It is all over. My lot has been so blessed that I can relate little of myself which is not a story of goodness and generosity in others. I may well pass that little and go on. When we were settled at Bleak House again, I had many conversations with my guardian, of which Richard was the theme.
It seems as if not even Ada can turn Richard from his belief that you are the enemy and the cause of his disappointment in the feud.
Poor Ada, and poor mistaken Rick. Well, we've all been mistaken over and over again. We must trust to Ada and to time to set him right.
I cannot help feeling, Guardian, that Mr. Skimpole is not the best of advisers for Richard.
Advisor? My dear, who would take advice from Harold Skimpole?
Encourager would perhaps have been a better word.
Encourager? Who would be encouraged by Skimpole?
Not Richard.
No. Such an unworldly, gossamer creature is a relief to Richard and an amusement.
So much of Richard's misunderstanding of you. He's come to his association with his new solicitor.
Ah.
It is to be regretted that Mr. Skimpole ever introduced Richard to Mr. Vholes.
Yes, Vholes will lead Richard on in the hopes of a settlement from that infernal suit until he has taken Richard's last halfpenny. What could Harold Skimpole have been thinking of that he should interest Richard in such a man?
I think Mr. Vholes made him a present of £5 for the introduction.
Did he? Did he? Ah, but there you have the man. There's nothing mercenary in that with him. He has no idea of the value of money. He means nothing by it and thinks nothing of it.
Mm.
Yes? What is it, James?
A gentleman to see you, sir. His card.
Thank you. Sir Leicester Dedlock. Oh, show him in.
Yes. Which way, sir?
Oh, Sir Leicester. Come in, come in.
Mr. Jarndyce, I do myself the honor of calling here.
Oh, you do me the honor, sir. Pray be seated.
Thank you.
There.
I do myself the honor of calling here on my road from Lincolnshire to express regret that any cause for complaint I have against the gentleman who has been your host should have prevented you and the ladies in your charge from seeing whatever little there may be to see at my house, Chesney Wolfe.
Thank you, Sir Leicester, and thank you on behalf of the ladies. Miss Summerson, as you see, is present here.
Ah, good afternoon, Miss Summerson. Yes, Mr. Jarndyce, it's possible that the gentleman to whom I have referred may have so misunderstood my character as to persuade you that you would not be received with the courtesy due to you. I assure you that is not the case.
Sir Leicester,
it gave me pain to learn from my housekeeper that a gentleman who was also in your company was deterred from examining the family pictures with the care he would have wished to bestow upon them.
The gentleman, what?
Mr. Harold Skimpling. I beg your pardon. Skimpole.
Harold Skimpole?
Yes. I have only recently heard of the incident. I am deeply sorry that such an impression should have been created upon you and your friend.
Pray say no more about it, Sir Leicester. Indeed, the mistake is mine, and I should apologize.
I mentioned the subject to Lady Dedlock, and my lady informed me that she'd had the pleasure of exchanging a few words with Mr. Jarndyce and his wards on the occasion of an accidental meeting. Permit me to repeat to you, sir, and to this lady, that I would be delighted if you chose to view my home. and that if you do so, I hope that I will have the good fortune to be in residence at the time.
Thank you. We shall avail ourselves of your kind invitation when we are next in the neighborhood, will we not, Esther? Esther?
I had difficulty in replying, but I murmured something I hoped passed for an assent. I had not once looked up. I had not seen the visitor, and had not even appeared to myself to hear the conversation. I'm surprised I can recall it. It made so little impression on me through the rushing in my head and the beating of my heart. After Sir Leicester had taken his leave, with great ceremony and politeness, I retired to my room to regain my self-control, and there I came to a decision.
May I come in, Gardner?
Oh, surely, my dear. What's the matter?
Nothing's the matter. I thought I'd like to take this quiet time to say a word to you about myself.
What concerns you concerns us all.
I have need, such need of your advice and support. Today's visitor...
Sir Leicester Dedlock?
Yes.
Why, Esther, you and Sir Leicester are the two last people on earth I'd have thought of connecting together.
I, too, till a little while ago.
What have you to tell me, Esther?
Do you remember when we were caught in the thunderstorm that Lady Dedlock spoke to you about her sister?
Of course I remember.
Why did they separate?
Why, I never knew. No one knew but themselves. Who could tell the secrets of those two proud, handsome women? You've seen Lady Dedlock. If you'd ever seen her sister, you'd have known that she was just as resolute, just as haughty.
I have seen her.
What?
I have seen her many, many times.
But then, when I told you that Boythorn was all but married once, did you know who the lady was?
Oh,
yes, it was Lady Dedlock's sister.
Why were they parted?
By her choice. She wrote to him and told him that from the date of her letter, she was dead to him. He never saw her again, and neither did anyone else. He never knew why.
What have I done?
You, Esther?
That sister was my first memory. My godmother. And Lady Dedlock. Lady Dedlock is my mother.
What are you saying?
She is my mother. I am her secret. A secret and her
shame. Lady Dedlock. That proud, beautiful woman. Oh, my dear. I won't question you now. But don't weep. Please. Don't weep. You must not blame yourself.
I'm better now. Guardian, what can we do?
Do? Oh, we can do nothing. You say this is your mother's secret, so we must keep it and, of course, avoid another meeting with Sir Leicester. I cannot help your mother, Esther. I could not speak to her, and if I could, she would not wish it. Sir Leicester does not know, of course.
No, he knows nothing.
Does anyone suspect the truth?
Yes.
Who?
Sir Leicester's lawyer, Mr. Tulkinghorn.
Indeed. Then I fear for your mother.
Do you know him?
I know him by sight. I know him by reputation. He's a dangerous man.
My mother feels that, too.
Does any suspicion lead to you?
From the lawyer, no. At one time, I feared that Mr. Guppy...
Of Kenyon Carboy?
Yes. He spoke once of finding out my history, of discovering something to my advantage. When I knew the truth, I made him promise to do no more about it.
Do you think he'll keep that promise?
Sure he will.
Then we can dismiss him for the present. Anyone else?
The French maid, Hortense.
Ah.
Do you remember her? She came to me and insisted that I should employ her. I sent her away.
A more alarming person than the lawyer's clerk, certainly. But, after all, my dear, it was natural enough that she should come to you for employment. She'd just been dismissed. And she'd seen you and Ada a little while before.
Her manner was strange.
Yes, yes. Her manner was strange on the day of the storm, too. But Esther,
You are unchanged. This secret does not make you a different person. Perhaps sharing it with you, I can lighten it.
Oh, indeed you can. Thank you, Guardian.
Esther, I...
Yes?
There is something I've long wanted to say to you. Give me your hand. Thank you. You have wrought changes in me, my dear. Oh, you've done me a world of good.
Oh, what have you not done for me?
Oh, no, that's not to be remembered now.
It can never be forgotten.
It is to be forgotten for a while. You're only to remember that nothing can change me as you know me. Can you feel sure of that?
Of course. I can and do.
Esther, I... oh, dear. I have some difficulty in saying what I wish to say. You are so young, and I am growing old. But I love you, Esther.
Oh, and I love you.
No, my child, you don't understand. I'm asking you to be the mistress of Bleak House. I'm asking you to be my wife. No. Do not speak. Do not answer me now. This is something you must think over for a long time. You see, you will gain nothing by such a marriage. And you will lose nothing if you reject it. My affection for you will never change. And whatever you decide, I know it will be right. You owe me nothing.
I owe you everything.
That's not to be thought of. And in any event, it is not true. I am in your debt. You have given me such happiness. Now think on this, my dear. When you have decided, come and tell me. And whatever you answer, remember, it will make no difference to the tender love I feel for you.
He did not say, but I knew that when I had been better looking, he had thought of this, but had refrained from speaking. He did not say, but I knew, that now, when my old face was gone, he loved me just as well. I left him because he wished it, and looking long at my plain face in the mirror as I brushed my hair, I told myself I was happy in the undeserved love of the best of men. I was very happy, very thankful, very hopeful. But I cried. I cried very much. As if something for which there was no name or distinct idea were indefinably lost to me. But why did it seem so strange that I should one day be the mistress of Bleak House? Other people had thought such things, if I had not. I recalled what Mrs. Woodcourt had said about my fortune, that I should marry a much older man. All at once I remembered the flowers. Mr. Woodcourt's flowers. They were in a book. It was weak in me, I know, but I dropped a tear on the page as I took the withered flowers out. I burned them at my candle, and they were dust in an instant. Next morning, I rose early and went down to the drawing room. My guardian was standing there, and he was alone.
It's you, Esther, is it?
Yes. Guardian, when would you like to have your answer?
When it is ready, my dear.
I think it is ready.
Yes.
My dearest. Dearest guardian.
Oh. Is this the mistress of Bleak House?
Yes. Oh, yes. And so, he had my promise. I said nothing to Ada about it, and life went on just as before. One morning, some weeks later, while I was walking in the garden, Charlie came to tell me that Mr. Jarndyce wished to speak to me. I went in at once and found him in company with a sallow man with pinched lips, dressed in black from head to toe and buttoned to the chin.
Ah, Esther, this is Mr. Vholes, Richard's legal advisor.
Good morning, Miss Summerson.
Good morning.
Mr. Vholes has brought an ugly report of our most unfortunate Rick. Would you be so good as to repeat it, Mr. Vholes?
I have reason to know, Miss Summerson, that Mr. Carston's circumstances are at present in an embarrassed state, and not so much in point of amount as in point of the pressing nature of the liabilities he has incurred. There is a limit to saving off, and I have reached it. I fear lest it may end in his obtaining leave to part with his commission.
Oh, dear, dear, dear.
I felt his connection should know.
Where is Richard stationed?
He is in Deal, Miss.
Oh, guardian, perhaps I...
One moment, Esther. Mr. Vholes, Miss Summerson will communicate with Mr. Carston, and we will hope that something can yet be done. May I order luncheon for you?
Thank you, no. I'm a poor knife and fork at any time. If you'll allow me, having accomplished what I came for, I will take my leave. You won't refer to me, miss, will you, when you communicate with Mr. C?
I'll be careful not to.
Well, thank you, miss. Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Jarndyce.
Oh, I'll go...
No, do not trouble yourself, sir. I shall see myself out.
Guardian, I must see Richard. Let me go down to Deal, please.
But Esther, the fatigue of such a journey...
I'm quite well now, you know that. And what else can we do? So, at our usual bedtime, Charlie and I were rolling seaward from London on the night mail. I had a loving letter from Ada to deliver to Richard, for of course we had told her of our mission. On a raw, misty morning, we arrived in the narrow streets of Deal. Many ships were lying in the harbour, including a large Indiaman surrounded by boats, which they told us had arrived during the night. We asked after Richard at the barrack gates, and were shown up a bare stair to a door where our escort knocked with his knuckles and left us.
Come in.
Wait here for me, Charlie.
Yes, miss.
Richard?
Esther, good heavens, how did you come here? Nothing's the matter, is it? Ada, is she quite well?
Quite well, and lovelier than ever.
Oh, my poor little cousin. Esther, I was in the middle of writing a letter to you, see?
You've been to the trouble of writing it. Can't I read it?
You may read what it says in this whole room, in this wretched confusion. It's all over.
Richard, don't be so cast down. I heard you were in difficulties. I came down to see if anything could be done.
That's like you. But it's useless, and that isn't like you. I'm going to leave today. In another hour, I'd have left. But that's just to smooth it over for my selling out. So this calling follows the rest. If I'd only been in the church, I'd have done the round of all the professions.
Surely, it's not so hopeless as that.
It is. It is indeed. I'm so near disgrace that the army'd rather be without me than with me. Apart from debts and drawbacks, I'm not fit for it. I've no mind, no heart for anything but the one cause. If I were ordered abroad, even if I weren't in debt, how could I go? I wouldn't even trust Vholes unless I were at his back.
Richard, you know that...
No, Esther. Two subjects are forbidden. One is John Jarndyce, and you know quite well what the second is. After all the time and anxiety I've spent on it, how can I abandon it now? Even though some people might like me to.
I have a letter for you from Ada.
Am I to read it now?
Yes.
Do you know what she says?
No.
She offers me her own little inheritance. Just as little and just as much as the one I've wasted. She asks me to take it, get myself right, and to remain in the service.
Your happiness is the dearest wish of her heart. I know that.
I wish that I were dead.
Richard!
This is the loving heart John Jarndyce tried to estrange from me, but... She makes her offer from under his roof. With his consent, perhaps. Is he trying to buy me off?
I will not have you say such things. For shame, Richard. Please, don't speak in such a tone to me.
I'm sorry. It was very wrong of me. I beg your pardon, Esther. But I can't accept Ada's offer. I've done with the red coats. And if I hadn't, they've done with me. Now, I can show you letters and papers to prove it.
Then what will you do?
Go to London.
Compound with my creditors.
You come back with me.
I shall be glad to.
It was true. He showed me the correspondence. The army had indeed finished with him. I had achieved nothing by coming down. On our way back to the hotel, where Richard was to join us, we saw a great concourse of people surrounding some naval officers who had just landed from the Indiaman. We pressed forward to look. Charlie! Charlie, come away!
What is it?
Nothing. I feel a little faint. I must get back to the hotel.
Yes, ma'am.
I had seen their faces. I had seen Alan Woodcourt. But I had not escaped. Back in our hotel room, I heard voices on the stairs and recognized his voice. The party had come to our hotel. My courage had quite failed me. I could not bear that he should see me so changed. But I knew this would not do. I was in a great tremble, but I called up all my resolution and wrote on one of my cards that I was at the hotel with Mr. Richard Carston. I sent it to Mr. Woodcourt, and he came immediately to see me. I put my veil half up. Perhaps I let it half down, I could not tell which. And I could see he was very, very sorry for me. Mr. Woodcourt, I'm so happy to be among the first to welcome you home. Miss Light told me how brave you'd be.
A little Miss Light. Is she just the same?
Just the same.
I was grieved to hear that you had been ill.
I was very ill.
You're quite recovered.
I'm quite recovered, and I'm very happy. I have everything in the world to be thankful for. What are your future plans, Mr. Woodcourt? Are you returning to India?
No, I doubt that very much. I went out a poor ship surgeon. I fear I've come back nothing better.
Come in.
Well, Esther, here I am. Why, Woodcourt, I didn't know you were in the country.
I arrived back last night. It was a great pleasure to discover that you and Miss Summerson are staying at the very same hotel. How are you?
Oh, indifferent. Esther will tell you how I've fared. But there is hope yet. Fortune will smile on me one day. We travelled to London tonight. Are we to have the pleasure of your company?
No, not tonight, I'm afraid. I have to stay by my ship a little longer. But London is my objective, tomorrow or the next day. Perhaps we can meet there.
Indeed we can.
Where can I find you?
Well, I had to get a lodging of some sort. Say, care of Bowles, Simmons Inn. Are you engaged for dinner tonight?
Why, no. At present, I have no engagements at all.
Good. Then we can all dine together before we take the London coach. Esther, will you forgive me? I have to see to my luggage. We see you this evening, then, Woodcourt.
I look forward to it. Miss Summerson, how is he?
In some trouble. He is estranged from my guardian and over-concerned with the Chancery suit.
I'm sorry to hear it.
Why did you ask? Did you find him so changed?
He is changed. I never saw so remarkable a look on a young person. It isn't all anxiety or all weariness. It is both. Like ungrown despair.
Do you think he's ill?
No, not ill.
He's not at peace in his mind, I know that. When you go to London, please see him. Please help him with your companionship, if you can.
I will be a true friend to him. I promise that.
Mr. Woodcourt kept his word. I soon heard from Richard that he had sought him out at Simmons Inn and shown him great kindness. He said that Mr. Woodcourt intended to resume practice among the poor.
What's the matter? Can I help you?
No, thank you, sir. Nothing's the matter.
Do you want to be let in? Can't you make them hear?
No, sir. I'm waiting out here till they wake up at another house, a larger house close by.
Your forehead is bleeding. Let me look at it. I'm a doctor.
I don't want to trouble you.
Don't be afraid. I wouldn't hurt you for the world. Yes, it's a bad bruise and the skin is broken. It must be very sore.
Do ache a little.
Let me try to make it more comfortable. I won't hurt you.
Oh, dear, no, sir. I'm sure of that.
So, your husband is a brickmaker.
Don't you know that?
From the colour of the clay on your bag and your dress. I know brickmakers go about working in different places, and I'm sorry to say I've known them cruel to their wives.
Well, he's not... Well, he can't help himself sometimes.
Hmm. Have you any settled home?
A good 3 and 20 miles from here, sir. St. Albans.
St. Albans?
Do you know it?
Yes, I know something of it. There. That will be more comfortable. What's your name?
Jenny. Thank you, sir. Joe. It's Joe. Oh, stop him, sir. Stop him.
What?
That boy. Stop him.
Yes. Boy.
Let me go. Joey.
Oh, hold on to him, sir. Oh. You, Joe. I found you at last.
Joe? I remember him. His lab was brought before the coroner.
Yeah. I saw he was before the inquest. Could you leave me alone? I've done nothing. English wasn't my fault. He was very good to me, he was. I wish I was English myself. I don't know why I don't go and make a hole in the water.
What has he done? Has he robbed you?
No, sir. He did nothing but kindness to me. But he was along with me down at St. Albans. Ill. And a young lady took pity on him when I dosed him and took him in.
You?
Yes. Took him home and made him comfortable. And he ran away in the night and never has been seen or heard of since. It was all along with him that she lost her look.
No.
I had heard of this. Joe, I...
Don't look at me like that. Ain't there nothing? It means nothing.
Get up.
Yes, sir.
You hear what she says? Why did you leave the house where the good young lady took you?
I never known about the young lady. She was very good to me, she was. I never meant for to hurt her. I had my head chopped off first.
Come on, why did you leave? Tell me.
I doesn't.
I must know.
Oh, well, I was took in the night.
Who took you?
I doesn't name him.
I won't tell anyone.
I don't know. As he won't hear.
Why, he's not in this place.
Oh, ain't he, though? He's in all manner of places. All at once.
Who is?
Come here, sir. I just whispered it.
Very well. Why? What have you been doing?
Nothing. Except for not moving on. I'm moving on now, all right. I'm moving on to the burying ground.
We'll try to prevent that, Joe. What did he want of you?
He put me in hospital. So when they discharged me, he gave me a little money and says, look it, here's our tramp. You move on. Don't let me see you nowhere within 40 miles of London.
I see. Well, come with me and I'll find you a better place than here to lie down and hide in. Jenny, it's getting light. I think they'll admit you to the lodging house now.
Yes, sir.
Please, I don't want to go.
They passed through the stagnant channel of mud, which is the main street of Tom All Alone's, onto the clearer air and high church spires of the city. Joe's breath rattles hoarsely in his chest, and Alan Woodcourt hastens his step, for it seems that Joe is indeed moving on, and no one can tread his road beside him. Finding a place of refuge for the boy presents a problem. Woodcourt takes it to Little Miss Flight, and on her advice, Trooper George is applied to, and undertakes to shelter him.
I'm most grateful for your kindness, Mr. George. I was unwilling to place the boy in a hospital or workhouse. He wouldn't stay in either place. He's possessed by an extraordinary terror of this person who ordered him to keep away from London.
You know the party's name?
Yes. His name is Bucket.
Bucket the detective?
The same man.
I know him. He's a rum customer.
The boy told me a strange story about his first encounter with Bucket. He was taken to some rooms in Lincoln's Inn Fields to identify a lady who had paid him money to see a particular grave. But apparently, the woman he saw there was not the lady.
I think I know where Bucket took him. Name of Tulkinghorn. That's who it is. His rooms.
Tulkinghorn? What kind of man is he?
A confoundedly bad kind of man. A slow, torturing kind of man. He's got a power over me, sir. He's the one who could tumble me out of this place neck and crop tomorrow. I spent half my life pretty well loitering and dodging about his door, and he keeps me dangling. He chafes and goads me till... Well, I'm glad I'll never have the chance to set spurs to my horse and ride at him in a fair field. But if I did, believe me, go down.
Sir. Yes? Sir. What is it, Joe?
He's not calling.
I just squeaked. I just decided to take the stairs to the cook's floor. I found a move and all right for office. With his duty. I'll be very thankful. The whole fact was there already. That's the only one to possible. I hope your message, Joe, my poor lad. The doctor was kind enough to tell me where you were. How do you find yourself?
Oh, I'm in luck, Mr. Snagsby. I don't want for nothing. I'm more comfortable than you can think. I'm very sorry I did it. But I didn't go for to do it.
To do what?
I wanted to give an illness to the lady as was. And it wasn't the other lady. None of them says nothing to me for having done it. The lady come herself. She saw me yesterday. All she says was, "Why, Joe, we thought we'd lost you." I turned to the wall, Mr. Snagsby. I really does. Mr. Woodcourt, I see his tears are falling.
Joe, here's half a crown. And don't tell my little
woman. What I was thinking of was, can you write very large?
Yes, Joe, please don't.
Uncommon large.
Yes, my poor boy.
Oh, and I was thinking, when I moved on, I can't go no further. Might you be so good, perhaps, as to write large, as I'm truly sorry, and I never went for to do it. And I know it was Mr. Woodcut, he cried over it. And if the writing was very large, he might forgive me.
It you'll say it, Joe. Very large.
That's what the car is. That's drawing heavy. I thought I was in Tom Orland again. Ain't there nobody about you, Mr. Woodcut?
Nobody.
And I ain't took back to Tom Orland.
No.
Oh, I'm very faithful.
Joe, did you ever know a prayer?
I never know nothing. Nothing at all. Oh, Mr. Chadbourne, he was praying once. And Mr. Snagsby. But he sounds as if he was speaking to himself. I never know what it was all about. I must go. I must get there. It's time for me to go to the burying ground.
Lie down. What burying ground, Joe?
Well, that lady was very good to me. Very good to me, he was. It's time for me to be put alongside him. I want to go there and be buried. Well, you promised Johnny took this, sir. And laid alongside him.
I will.
Thank you, sir. Well, I'll have to get the key of the gates. It's always locked. And there's a step there as I used to clean with my broom. It's so very dark. It's very light a-coming.
It's coming fast,
too. I hear you. I was groping in the dark. Now let me catch you, Anne.
Can you say after me what I say?
I'll say anything you say, for I know it's good.
Our Father.
Our Father. Yeah. That's very good, sir.
Which art in heaven?
Please. Our art in heaven. Is the light a-coming?
It is close at hand, Joe. Hallowed be thy name.
Hallowed be thy
the light is come upon the dark, benighted way. Dead. Dead, Your Majesty. Dead, my lords and gentlemen. Dead, right reverence and wrong reverence of every order. Dead, men and women born with heavenly compassion in your hearts. And dying thus around us every day.
How is the parliamentary election progressing in the north, Mr. Tulkinghorn? I understand that you have been there lately.
I'm afraid, Sir Leicester, your party have no chance there. Mrs. Rouncewell's son...
Yes, I remember you told me they wished to put him up as a candidate. I was glad to hear that he had sufficient sense of propriety to decline.
Nonetheless, he's a very good speaker and has great influence. And he was much assisted by his son.
His son? Not the son who wished to marry the young woman in my lady's service.
He has but one son.
Then, upon my honor, the floodgates of society are burst open. The country is going to the devil. My lady, in reference to that young woman...
I've no intention of parting with her.
Well, no, that was not my meaning. As you think her worthy of your patronage, I suggest you keep her from these dangerous hands.
However, it is worthy of remark. These people are, in their way, very proud.
Proud?
I'd not be surprised if they all abandoned the girl instead of her abandoning them if she remained at Chesney World.
Well, you should know, Mr. Tulkinghorn, you've been amongst them.
I could tell you a story with Lady Dedlock's permission.
A true story?
A true story. I have only just heard of it. If I suppress names, I trust you will not think me ill-bred.
Certainly not.
A townsman of this Mr. Rouncewell had a daughter who attracted the notice of a great lady. Married to a gentleman of your condition, Sir Leicester.
Yes, Mr. Tulkinghorn.
The lady was wealthy and beautiful. She liked the girl and treated her with great kindness. But it seems that for many years she had preserved a secret. Early in life she'd been engaged to marry a young rake, a captain in the army. She never married him, but she had a child by him.
Dear me.
Captain died, and she thought her secret safe. But through an imprudence on her own part, she was discovered. I leave you to imagine the husband's grief, Sir Leicester. But that is not the present point. When Mr. Rouncewell's townsman heard of the disclosure, he indignantly took his daughter away, as if from a reproach and disgrace. That is the story.
It is difficult to credit.
I can assure you it is the truth. I hope Lady Dedlock will excuse its painful nature. My lady.
I must speak with you.
If you wish, Lady Dedlock.
Why have you told my story?
To inform you that I knew it.
For how long?
I suspected it long ago. I've known it only a little while.
Months?
Days.
Is it true about that poor girl? Do her friends know my story? Is it the town talk? Is it chalked upon walls and cried in the streets?
No, Lady Dedlock. That was a hypothetical case. But it would be real if they knew what we know.
Can I save the girl before they know it?
Really, I can't answer that.
You've prepared me for exposure. Thank you. Is there anything you require of me? Do you wish me to write anything certifying to the exactness of your discovery? I will do it here and now, if you wish.
I will not trouble you. Pray spare yourself.
I do not wish to be spared. You can do nothing worse to me now.
If you will allow me...
My jewels are all in their proper place of keeping, and so are all the valuables I have. Tomorrow, make it known I went to be henceforth lost. I lay no other charge upon you.
I am not sure that I understand you. You went?
I leave Chesney World tonight forever.
No, Lady Dedlock.
What? Have you forgotten the stain, the blot upon this place?
Not by any means, but I have not yet come to a decision on the course before me. I am not yet clear what to do. how to act, I must request you in the meantime to keep your secret as you have kept it so long, and not to wonder that I keep it too. My sole consideration in this unhappy case is Sir Leicester.
Then why do you detain me in this house?
Because he is the sole consideration. He is a very proud man. The fall of that moon from the sky would not amaze him more than your fall from your high position as his wife. Nothing could prepare him for such a blow.
Not my flight?
Your flight would spread the truth, and 100 times the truth. The wall chalking and street crying would come on directly. If I inflicted this shock upon Sir Leicester tomorrow, how could the change in him be accounted for? Besides, Sir Leicester is devoted to you almost to infatuation. He might not be able to overcome that infatuation, even knowing what we know.
Then I am to drag my present life on at your pleasure, day by day. I am to be so tied to the stick.
I'm afraid it is necessary.
I am to remain on this gaudy platform, waiting for it to fall beneath me when you give the signal?
I shall take no step without warning you.
We are to meet as usual.
Precisely as usual.
And I am to hide my guilt, as I've done for so many years.
Your secret can be no heavier to you than it was before. I know it, certainly, but I believe we've never really trusted one another.
Then is there anything more to be said?
Why, I should like to be assured of your acquiescence in my arrangements.
You may be assured of it.
Mr. Tulkinghorn opens the door for her and makes an old-fashioned bow as she passes out. It is not an ordinary look he receives from the handsome face as it goes into the darkness, but he reflects that the woman has been putting no common constraint upon herself. Next day, like a dingy London bird among the birds at roost in the pleasant fields of Lincolnshire, the lawyer returns to the stale air and dust of the city. He unlocks his door and settles into his customary leather armchair, looking up at his painted ceiling, where the curly-haired Roman leans out of the clouds and points accusingly downwards.
Mistress Hortense, what do you want?
Let me in, then I will tell you. I have had trouble to find you, sir. It has always been said to me, he's not at home, he's engaged.
Quite true.
Not true, lies.
Do you have anything to say? Say it.
Sir, you have not used me well. You have catched me to give you information. You have asked me to show you the dress my lady must have worn that night. You have prayed me to come here to meet that boy. Is it not so?
Well, I paid you.
You paid me? 2 sovereigns. I have not changed them. I despise them. I throw them from me. Now, you have paid me, eh?
You must be rich, my fair friend, to throw money about in that way.
I am rich. I'm very rich in hate. I hate my lady in my heart, you know that.
How should I know it?
You knew perfectly when you asked me to tell you those things. You made sure of me because you knew that I detest her.
Have you anything else to say?
I'm not yet placed. Place me well. If you cannot do this, employ me to pursue her, to disgrace and dishonor her. I will help you well. I know this is what you do.
You appear to know a great deal.
I'm not so weak as to believe, like a child, that I was brought here in that dress only to decide a wager.
I see. You come now to make this remarkably moderate demand. If it is not conceded, you will come again.
And again. And again. Forever.
Very well. Now, Mademoiselle Hortense, I recommend that you pick up your money.
I will not.
So much the poorer you, so much the richer I. Look, mistress, this is the key of my wine cellar. It is a large key, but the keys of prison are larger. The law here prevents any of our English citizens being troubled, even by ladies' visits against his desire. Make another visit here and you will find that out.
You will send me to prison.
If you come here again, I will give you over to the police. They carry troublesome people through the streets, strapped on a board.
You dare not do it.
You do not know me, mademoiselle. Now you'd better go. Think twice before you come here again.
Think you twice, 200 times.
You were dismissed by your lady as the most implacable and unmanageable of women. Now take warning. Turn over a new leaf. For what I say, I mean, and what I threaten, I will do.
The days grow shorter, and Sir Leicester and his lady return to town. The fashionable world receives Lady Dedlock with open arms, and she moves, beautiful and unapproachable as ever, from banquet to theater and from opera to ball. And always the lawyer watches and waits.
Mr. Runswell, pray be seated. My solicitor, Mr. Tulkinghorn.
Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon.
My lady wished to speak to you, Mr. Runsworth.
I shall be happy to hear anything Lady Dedlock does me the honor to say.
Pray, sir, has anything passed between you and your son regarding your son's fancy?
When we last met, I said I would seriously advise my son to conquer his fancy.
And did you?
Of course I did.
Has he done so?
Really, Lady Dedlock, I cannot make you a definite reply. No. I fear not. In our condition of life, we sometimes couple an intention with our fancies, which renders them not altogether easy to throw off. I think it is rather our way to be in earnest.
I've been thinking on the subject, which is tiresome to me.
I'm very sorry, I'm sure.
And of what Sir Leicester said on it, with which I quite agree. If you cannot give me an assurance that this fancy is at an end, I've come to the conclusion that the girl had better leave us.
I can give no such assurance, Lady Dedlock.
Then she'd better go.
Excuse me, my lady. This may be doing an injury to the young woman she has not deserved.
The girl is a very good girl. I have nothing whatever to say against her. But she is in love, or supposes she is, poor little fool, and so does not appreciate the advantages of her present position.
In that case, of course, I agree. The young woman had better go.
I have already told her so. You may take her with you, Mr. Runsway.
Lady Dedlock, I beg your pardon for intruding on you.
What do you want?
I am rather surprised by the course you have taken.
Indeed?
Yes, I was not prepared for it. I consider it a departure from our agreement. I feel myself under the necessity of saying that I do not approve of it.
I do not understand.
Oh, yes, you do. Come, we must not fence and parry now. You know you like the girl.
Well?
And you know that you have not sent her away for the reasons you gave, but for the purpose of separating her as much as possible from any reproach and exposure that impend over yourself.
Well, sir?
I object to that. I know it to be unnecessary, and I consider it dangerous. It is a proceeding calculated to awaken speculation and rumor in us. Besides, it is a violation of our agreement. You were to be exactly what you were before. This afternoon, your behavior was very different.
If, sir, your knowledge of my secret...
Lady Dedlock, it is no longer your secret. It is my secret. In trust for Sir Leicester and the family.
That is very true. If, in my knowledge of the secret, I do what I can to spare an innocent girl from the taint of my impending shame, and remember the hypothetical story you yourself told me, I do what I have resolved to do. Nothing can shake me.
Really? Then you are not to be trusted. So put the case very plainly, and you are not to be trusted.
I spoke to you about the girl before.
Yes, but that was before we came to our agreement. Both the letter and the spirit of our agreement precluded any action on your part based on my discoveries. What does the girl matter, after all? Here is a family name compromised. That overrides all other considerations. Now I come to the most disagreeable part of this interview.
I think I can anticipate it.
Our agreement is broken. A lady of your strength of character will be prepared for my now declaring it void and taking my own course.
I am quite prepared. Do you intend undeceiving Sir Leicester tonight?
No.
Tomorrow?
I'd better decline answering that question. It may be tomorrow. I would rather say no more.
Do you intend remaining in this house any time?
No. I'm going home.
Three quarters after seven. The clock upon the staircase is a splendid clock, famous for its accuracy. A famous clock indeed it would be if it said to this old man, "Don't go home. Tonight of all nights, don't go home." He passes out into the street and walks on in the moonlight under the shadow of the lofty houses, many of whose mysteries, difficulties, and mortgages are trussed up in his old black satin waistcoat. He is in the confidence of the very bricks and mortar. The high chimney stacks telegraph family secrets to him, yet there is not a voice in a mile of them to whisper, "Don't go home." 10 o'clock. A quiet night and a bright moon. Even in this stranger's wilderness of London, there is some rest. Its steeples and towers and its one great dome grow more ethereal. The smoky housetops lose their grossness. The sound of footsteps is muffled. And in the very city itself, outside Mr. Tulkinghorn's darkened chambers, every sound seems merged into a distant, ringing hum.
You heard it, didn't you?
Yes, I heard it.
What was it?
It sounded like a shot.
Where did it come from?
I couldn't say.
Seems quiet enough now.
Yes. Boy, there can't have been anything.
We'd best be getting home. Good night, you.
Did Mr. Tulkinghorn hear? His windows are dark and quiet, and his door is locked. For it would take a cannon to shake that rusty old man out of his immovable composure. But the next morning, when they come to clean his rooms...
God in mercy.
The curly-haired Roman on Mr. Tulkinghorn's ceiling has something to point at now. He is pointing at a table with a bottle of wine and a glass upon it. He is pointing at an empty chair and at something on the ground below it. For many years to come, he will point at a particular stain upon the floor that could be covered by one hand but cannot ever be got out. As long as damp and dust and spiders spare him, he will point, with far greater significance than he did in Mr. Tulkinghorn's time. For Mr. Tulkinghorn's time is over forevermore, and the Roman points towards him, lying face downwards on the floor. Shot through the heart.
In part 6 of Charles Dickens's Bleak House, dramatized in 8 episodes by Betty Davis, the part of Esther Summerson was played by Brenda Blethyn, and Mr. Jarndyce by Michael Bryant. Joe, Danny Webb. Trooper George, Michael Graham Cox. Alan Woodcourt, Adam Barham. Mr. Tulkinghorn, Robert Lang. Lady Dedlock, Sarah Kestelman. Sir Leicester Dedlock, Jack May. Richard and Lucia. Charlie, Angela Pheasants. Jenny, Teresa Stretfield. Hortense, Stella Forge. Mr. Snagsby, Hugh Dixon. Mr. Voles, Ronald Herdman. Mr. Rouncewell, Alan Duffy. With Catherine Parr, Nicholas Courtney, and Stephen Garlick. And Simon Cadell as Charles Dickens. The director was Jane Morgan.